Hello, and welcome to another episode of Cybersecurity for All podcast, a podcast all about cybersecurity from ApeTech. I'm your host, Alex, and today I have a special treat for you. I have the honor of interviewing my professor from WashU. He taught me everything I know about cybersecurity, and now he's a best-selling author. We'll be talking about his book, Entrepreneurship, Leadership, and much more. I really hope you enjoy this one. Please help me blow up this episode by sharing it with everyone you know. Thanks for the support, and let's get into the episode. All right, so this is Christian Espinosa. Is my very first cybersecurity professor back in 2015, 2016 timeframe when I was going to WashU in St. Louis, Missouri. So a lot of what I know within the world of cybersecurity came from this amazing person here. And you recently wrote a book, and I actually have it, and I've read the whole thing. I spent the last week and a half, 2 weeks reading it, so it was a really good book. And so we're going to be unpacking a little bit about the book and then I'm talking about just cybersecurity in general. And I have some awesome questions. So if there's anything you want to add, Christian, feel free to mention anything I might have forgotten and that you want to highlight.
Yeah, well, thanks for the intro, Alex. It's been quite some time since we've seen each other. It was like 2016, like you said, at WashU. That was right after I formed my business, which I sold my business in December of 2020. So I think when you met me, I was still doing a lot of the work myself. I was a owner and an operator. So now I'm more doing strategy and things like that. So I'm not doing classes myself anymore. I kind of miss doing the classes sometimes though.
Yeah, I was really surprised when I saw, I think one of the first conversations I had with you on social media within 2020 was, my first question was, are you still teaching? And your answer was no. And that kind of threw me off a little bit because you were such a great professor, right? You were very good at explaining everything. And as a student, right, like I've had so many professors, and just being able to take that technical stuff and making it meaningful, like all the hands-on activities that you made us do, was just super beneficial.
Yeah. So I don't do teaching, but I do sales now. So I have to, it's sort of related with sales. I take technical things and relate them to business terms and all that. So it's a similar skill set, but you know, it's obviously a little bit different.
Okay. So from CEO of your own company to an author, like how did you make that transition, or what was the thought process behind wanting to sit down and write a book?
So with my company, I had a lot of challenges. And the challenges were not technical challenges. They were people skills challenges. I realized if I looked at all the major problems I had in my organization, they were because one of my highly technical people made a client feel stupid or not appreciated or not understood. It had nothing to do with a lack of technical skills. So what I realized was, you know, my hiring model was wrong. I would hire people based on their technical skills and then look at their people skills last. So I flipped that over and starting hiring people based on cultural fit, EQ skills, people skills first, alignment with what we believed in. And then I also trained my existing staff on those skills. So the book is really seven steps that I call it the secure methodology, that were the result of the things I tried with my business to shift us from, you know, just a high IQ, super technical staff to a high IQ, but also with the EQ skills, because ultimately every business we're in, we deal with people. So if we're dealing with a prospect or a client, you know, they're going to come back to us if they feel understood and appreciated. So that's what I wrote the book about, was that journey of realizing that with my organization, I needed to make a shift with my technical staff. And in cybersecurity, I think we've allowed this culture where if you have a high IQ, it's okay to have like no people skills and treat people horribly. And we've created this sort of monster in the industry, and it's caused a lot of problems in my experience.
Yeah. One of the things I found interesting with the way you not only brought your personal life into the book, but the way you brought in so many other books and lessons learned from other books, right? Because I had read Extreme Ownership. I had read Growth Mindset. Watched The Matrix. So being able to, the way you just folded all that in and the way you started with stories and making it all relevant, I thought was an interesting way, right? Because 1 year I decided, so I usually give myself a challenge of reading 25 books a year, just to try to read one every 2 weeks, right? So 1 year I got a little crazy, and instead of reading them sequentially, which was it step 5 or step 6 about monotasking, resonated a little bit more.
Yeah, yeah.
But I decided to do 10 books at the same time, one chapter, in this just a round robin effect, right? And it just played all kinds of tricks with me, because I was taking concepts from one book and immediately being able to like mesh it with the concept from another book, which normally you like enough time passes that you forget something from a chapter or something else. So when I was reading your book, it kind of felt like a little bit like that, where we're just meshing just highlights from various different leadership books and just putting it all together into a relevant way to share your message.
Yeah. So just wanted... You might be onto something there with 10 books at a time, one chapter each, and kind of integrating them between each other. That's an interesting concept.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I was reading Everything is Figureoutable by Marie Forleo.
Okay.
And then I was reading a Malcolm Gladwell book, and they were just like interesting because they're talking similar things but from different perspectives. And I was able to like grab just concepts from one and concepts from the other one and kind of connect them. And then the crazy part was I started applying them at work. So to share a little bit of history too. So once I left Boeing in 2016, because I ended up coming to California, as you know, I have a top secret. Well, I have a clearance. I had a clearance when I was at Boeing. Yeah. And Boeing lost a multi-billion-dollar contract against Northrop Grumman in 2016. And so Northrop Grumman went to Boeing in St. Louis, and basically anybody that had a clearance, they set up shop at a bar across the street on Olive, really. And 170, what is it, 170 and Olive? It's been a while since I looked at a map of St. Louis. But they were down there in that area, and they basically just 5 minutes later, they just asked me, like, do you want to move to California? I said, yeah. And so they're like, okay, go negotiate your salary. So 5 minutes later, I got a full ride to move to California, all expenses paid by the company. And I was in DevOps for a while, and then I switched over to technical program management. So I left the tech, like really deep technical roles that I used to have, and went into a very big, like managing people type of role, right? And I've struggled a lot, which is why I've taken on this challenge of reading all these books on leadership, because empathy and the EQ is such a critical part of delivering a product, or specifically a software project. So again, it was really beneficial to read your book and kind of see how the principles from your book can definitely apply way beyond even just cybersecurity, right? I see it in the software engineering world, and just working with people there. So, okay, great. Let me move on to some other topics. So a lot of the secure methodology, the way I was reading it and interpreting it is it's really valuable, specifically when you can like have everybody in the room, right? But from your experience, and also correct me if I'm wrong, but I felt like as I was reading it that you started the book pre-pandemic and then kind of finished it during the pandemic, or was the whole book written during the pandemic?
Yeah, that's a good way of stating that. I started it in January of 2020, and I finished at the end of 2020. So I started right before the pandemic and finished in the middle of the pandemic. So a lot of things had shifted while I was writing the book.
Yeah, so cause I saw the last couple of chapters, it was like a lot, it would mention pandemic and COVID a little bit more versus the beginning chapters didn't really touch about it. But my question is, so the EQ, right? Being able to read those. I remember when I took your class, you were learning about like micro expressions, right? Like you were looking at like miniature tweaks in the face and stuff like that. But body language is so hard to see. When I literally, I joined a company and I've only known my coworkers from the chest up, right? So I don't know what they're doing with their hands. I don't know what they're doing with their feet. I don't know if they're sweating, if their heart's elevated, right? Like a lot of the additional cues that you need to kind of read the room are challenging in the pandemic world. So how do you see secure methodology being implemented with leadership right now in this like remote work from home world?
Yeah, that's a good question. So with my company, before I sold it, I didn't have people come to the office. Periodically, they came to the office, which was in Illinois. O'Fallon, Illinois, right outside St. Louis. But we worked from home most of the time. I didn't think people should commute unless they had a reason to. And one of the challenges I had initially was nobody wanted to be on camera. So like you said, it's specifically hard to get someone to read on something that's no one's on camera, and half the time they're zoned out. So I made it a policy that people had to be on camera, and they had to have a decent camera. They had to stay on camera, and they had to be present during the meeting. So I did a lot of things from a cultural perspective to help with that, because it is a big challenge today. It's much better in person, obviously, because you can feel the energy from somebody. You can't really feel the energy from somebody through the screen as much. You can get a sense based on their eyes and, you know, micro expressions, what's going on with them if they're on camera. But it's not the same thing as in person. So I still prefer in person. But I think if with meetings today, if everyone's on camera and people are present, it's a way to the best we can do, you know, in a remote workforce way in a pandemic sort of environment.
Yeah. And I can relate because when I was at Northrop towards the end of my career there, part of my responsibilities was building all these relationships with my peers, right? I worked with two separate companies, Raytheon and Northrop, to build this multi-million-dollar project. Mm-hmm. And being able to empathize with my peers and being able to maybe not necessarily like give instructions, but do more like ask for favors, helped me accelerate myself, right? It helped me accomplish the goals, right? But then I quit and I went to a startup, and my first day at the startup was the first day that California shut down. Mm-hmm. And so I never met anybody but my manager and the people that gave me my laptop. And I struggled. I really struggled to build relationships, and I struggled to feel the emotions that my peers would feel, right? Everybody kind of had a sense of frustration that we all shared of like working from home and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But in general, it was just really hard to connect, right? And then I also had to deal with managers. And this is one of the questions I'm going to ask you is, like, a lot of the managers that I was working with, they killed like team bonding activities, right? So we would run, I'm not sure how much you're familiar with Scrum or Agile principles, but a sprint retrospective mm-hmm. is a ceremony that you do at the end to kind of reflect, right? And all that was killed. And like my abilities to be able to form bonds and just relationships with my peers kind of went away. So my question in general here, talking about like relationships and stuff, is like, how do you deal with like managers? Because as I'm reading through everything in your book, and I'm just trying to apply it, like, it's great when you're in a leadership role. And I think you really wrote the book towards like leadership and executives, right? But what about somebody that's like mm-hmm. a little bit farther down the chain, right? The ladder of success, but they want to exhibit these leadership capabilities, but it's just daunting, or they just don't have enough clout. Like, what would you say to somebody like that? Like, how can they start influencing top management?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. 'Cause right now for me, I'm not the CEO of my business anymore because I sold it. So I'm a managing director for Cerberus Sentinel, the parent company that bought mine. So my leadership style is more through influence now than authority. So in influencing peers and people that I work for. So what I think is important is, you know, in order to lead others or to influence others, you have to lead yourself and influence yourself. So that means, if you show up for a meeting, to turn your camera on and be present. As much as you sometimes don't want to, you know, you have to set the example. That means to show up for the meeting and you know, be in the right mindset when you get there, for instance. So a lot of it is setting the example, but then also I think using influence in a way where you ask the right questions, but not in a way to make somebody feel disrespected or misunderstood or like or stupid, really. But you ask questions and have a conversation that helps influence the scenario and the direction you want it to go. And I think this is the challenge we all have. We learn all these things in like elementary school, but we don't ever learn like you know, conversation skills or how to have a crucial conversation. But you know, you mentioned I talk about a lot of books in my book. You know, one of them I don't talk about in the book, but it's crucial conversations. So how to have a crucial conversation and how to have a, you know, a shared pool of knowledge. So we all want to get to this, do this one thing. So instead of like making someone get defensive or feel offended, you know, you lay it out there as here's where we want to go. Let's drop our ideas. And it's a different tactic that you can use to influence your leadership, but it requires a certain skill set. It requires you to be, take a little risk as well. A lot of us don't want to take risk or put ourselves out there because we're afraid if I do this and somebody thinks it's stupid, I'm going to look bad, right? So it requires some courage to take those steps also. So I think a lot of leadership is really courage. And it doesn't matter what your position is, you have to demonstrate some courage.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword because I've had to take stances and stuff for things that I believe in, but there's a certain finesse that you have to do with the way you express yourself. Because as the creatures that we are, specifically like being an engineer, and like we just don't learn enough psychology, yet we work with humans all day, right? And I think that's a missed opportunity where it's like everything that we're dealing with, like you don't know if somebody's having problems at home and that's why they're like being super rude at work, right? But that moment of rudeness can like forever alter a relationship at work, and people don't try to fix it, right? Like usually people become the evil person at work, and then you get labeled, and then it's always really challenging to like recover a relationship after that point. But yeah, all right. Go ahead. No, let's finish this thought.
Oh, I was just gonna say I don't think I talk about this book either, but one of the things I do a reread periodically is The Four Agreements, which talks about you know, being impeccable with your word, not taking things personally, not making assumptions, and you know, always doing your best. So we tend to make assumptions, like you said, like someone just doesn't like us or something, but like you said, they could be just had a bad day at home, and then we make an assumption and we take it personally, which doesn't move the situation forward. So if you reread those four agreements and try not to make the assumption about what's going on with someone, or try not to take things personally, it helps you move forward with somebody. It helps you with your relationship with them, from my experience.
Okay. So I want to transition a little bit. I kind of want to go then like your 2014, 2015 timeframe. So just to share a little backstory, I was at the startup for about a year. And I learned a lot about running a business because when I was at Northrop and Boeing, like these are huge 100,000 people company, and you're like less than 0.01% of the bottom line, right? Like your contributions are almost insignificant in an organization that size. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to, since I had learned all these skills on how to work with people and how to like orchestrate and coordinate and get everybody to like band together to deliver a product, I wanted to go try it somewhere where maybe I could have a bigger impact. And so I went to a small 300-person startup here in San Diego. And while I was there, I learned a lot during that year. But what I learned the most at the end of that year, and it's probably what the part that resonated the most from your book on me, was when you quit your job as a VP with no backup plan, it just brought me back to April 2nd, where I walked out of my job after turning a 2 weeks notice with absolutely no plan. Other than I knew whatever I was doing wasn't fulfilling me, and I knew it wasn't enough, and I wanted to not get to the age of 80 years old and regret not having started something. Because ever since I was in St. Louis, I actually prepped my basement as like a workshop, because I've always wanted to build something, but I was always too scared because I've always had a mortgage, I've always had kids and responsibilities and stuff, right? So I finally decided, you know what, I'm gonna do it. So walk me through your thought process when you quit, right? And you started your company, because one of the things this pandemic has caused that I've been seeing a lot on social media is I'm not alone in this journey, right? I actually did it because of all the other people I've witnessed on TikTok and on Twitter doing the same thing, quitting their jobs and then starting their own businesses. But since you've done it and you've been successful, I kind of just wanted to see if you can walk me through some of your thought process and the challenges that you observed as you were venturing to these new untested waters.
When I quit the company, I forgot the year actually, I was having some misalignment with the CEO. I worked for the CEO, and it was causing me a lot of anxiety and affecting my health and well-being, I felt. So that's why I quit. I decided, you know, it didn't matter how much money they offered me, I wasn't staying. It didn't matter if they offered me $1 billion. You know, my sanity and my well-being was worth more than that. So that's when I quit without having anything lined up. So what it did, though, and sometimes these moments you think are, you know, the most difficult moments are actually the best moments for you, right? So what happened is I had built a pretty big network of people. So I reached out to my network and started doing freelance work. So I did freelance work for about 5 years, and I learned a lot of different skills of freelance work, you know, how to do invoicing, because you're basically a solopreneur. How to do invoicing, yeah, how to maintain client relations, how to manage your expenses, how to do your taxes. I kind of built a foundation with that. Yeah, exactly. And then after about 5 years of that, I kind of got bored with it. I thought, you know what, I'm sort of stagnated. I didn't feel like I was growing. I was making a lot of money. The routine was easy for me, but I felt like I wasn't contributing or growing enough. So I thought, well, what else can I do? So then I thought, well, you know what? I'm going to start a company and hire some people. Because an opportunity landed in my lap that I couldn't do myself either about the same time. So I thought I can either turn this opportunity down, or I could build a business, bring some people under me, and try to fulfill this opportunity. And that's what I did. And that, you know, starting the business with doing a solopreneur thing, it has a lot of challenges, but it's super simple compared to, you know, having a business where you have employees, payroll, you know, a lot of other things involved, cash flow issues, because it's not just yourself. So going mm-hmm. through that process for me was, it was forced growth. It forced me to grow a lot of ways, because I'm a believer that your business is a reflection of you. So as the owner and the leader of the business, if it wasn't doing well, that was because there's something inside of me that was causing us not to do well. Either I couldn't make this decision, I couldn't, you know, get above this glass ceiling, I was too afraid to take this step, or whatever. So that journey really forced me to, you know, kind of get my act together in a lot of ways and grow. But it also wasn't simple. I paid a lot of dumb tax, as they like to say. I made a lot of mistakes, and I paid for it a lot. You know, because I almost lost my business several times. I almost went bankrupt, basically. And, you know, several times I was like one paycheck away, you know, from bankruptcy, a check from a client from bankruptcy. So that was a lot of forced personal growth, and it wasn't easy at all, but it did help me grow tremendously. Hey, you're back. Sorry, there's like a thunderstorm here. I don't know if you hear the lighting in the background. I don't know if that's what's going on or what.
What is a thunderstorm?
I know, right? Every day is like 60, 65 and sunny there in San Diego. It's the same day.
Yeah. No, I went in 2019. When I moved out in 2016, I was planning on selling my house, and I did everything getting ready because the relocation company was going to take care of everything. But they basically mm-hmm. wanted a brand new home. And in the Midwest, your houses get beat up a lot, right? So it's like almost impossible to have like a brand new home in the Midwest, unless it's brand new. And so I decided to I backed out at the very end. I said, you know what, I'm just going to keep it. And I ended up renting it out to a coworker of mine, and he moved in, and he was there for a couple of years, but his wife was not terminally ill, but she's like almost bed rest ill, where she can't move. She has like a few dislocated discs on her back. So he said, you know what, I got to go back to be with my wife, because he was only in St. Louis for the insurance. And his wife actually lived in Arizona. He ended up figuring it out, and he moved back. And so I went to go try to sell the house, and I went with every intention to sell it. And as I'm driving down the freeway, I'm remembering everything of St. Louis. And I remember just the 31 months that I lived in St. Louis, I hated it. It was something that I just never wanted to do. But I left California as a kid, and I became an adult in St. Louis. Okay. Coming back to California as an adult sucks. Like, this is not a state for adults. Because really? It's so expensive, right? Like,
yeah.
So being out there, like, I've just missed everything. And so everything here is so fast paced, right? Everybody's in a hurry. There's no kindness of any kind. Even at work, everybody's ultra competitive. Everybody's always just trying to step on top of each other. And when I was with my coworkers in St. Louis, I never felt that way. I always felt everybody's building each other up. It's kind of a weird cultural thing out here. But anyways, the point I was trying to make here was my first night in St. Louis, I called my wife. I'm like, we can't sell this house. It's bringing back too many memories. This is my first home and stuff like that. And then the second night, there was a thunderstorm and I called her back up. I go, I remember why we left.
Yeah.
And it's because
of the humidity and the thunderstorms. Yeah.
That and the mosquitoes. I hadn't remembered so many mosquitoes when I lived out there. Like, we don't have mosquitoes out here.
Yeah, there are a lot of mosquitoes.
You can go outside and come back and still have your body all in one piece. okay, so I was going to ask you, with your business, right? I want to ask you two things. Like, one, did you have like a support person or a mentor or a coach or somebody that was kind of like not guiding you, but just maybe have somebody to bounce fear or thoughts off of?
When I first started my business, I thought I could figure it all out myself, that I didn't need any help. And that was something I had to get over. So then maybe a year into it, I joined a Vistage peer group with other CEOs. But even after a year of that, I still wasn't being vulnerable and wasn't, I was like pretending I had it figured out, but I didn't. So it took me a while to actually get the help I needed and to be willing to be vulnerable. And during this whole time, I think for about 3.5 years now, I've had like a life coach as well. Like someone I talk to once every week or once every 2 weeks. And, you know, I realized that, you know, what got me so far in the business and in my life wasn't going to get me to the next level. So I needed outside help from either peers. So I joined the Vistas group. And then I had the life coach. I joined a couple of masterminds. I did a lot of things that really helped me, but they only helped me when I started putting the work and the effort into it. Just joining something, if you're not, you know, going and showing up with the right intentions or the right outcomes, not going to really help. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I needed the outside perspective.
Yeah, with me personally, right, I've been doing this for, this is going to be the end of my second month that I left, right? And I've always had a job lined up. I've always had a steady income. And it's an emotional roller coaster like I've never experienced in my life. Because there's days where I wake up and a bunch of people listen to my podcast or my TikToks, because we'll talk about TikTok in a little bit.
Okay.
But my TikToks will take off and I got like 80,000 views or something. But then there's other days where I just like, it's rejection after rejection after rejection of like potential clients, because I'm doing freelancing on the side, trying to just maintain the lights, right? And so how do you, like, do you have any perspectives or like something motivational with how to deal with rejections? Because that tends to be like my biggest pain point is when I get bad news, man, it just like almost destroys my whole day. It's hard to come back from that.
Yeah, so that goes back to those four agreements. Two of them are don't make assumptions or why someone rejected you. It could be something going on with them, and don't take it personally. I know that's easier said than done. The other thing that I've always kept in mind is the people that I've noticed have been the most successful. I remember I used to listen to like a Success magazine used to have a CD, and you could listen to the CD back in the day when people had CDs. I used to drive around listening to CDs, and I remember listening to this interview with Sarah Blakely. She started Spanx and is like a billionaire. But she said one of the things that helped her the most was she used to sell something door to door, and she would get rejected all the time. But she got used to getting rejected and not taking it personally. And I remember hearing that from her and several other people that were very successful. Like, they started off in a scenario making cold calls or getting rejected, but they got over that. So once you get over that, it's much easier to make the next call if you don't take it personally. And that's the thing that's always struck me, because I do sales now. I had to do sales for my company. And like you're talking about, you know, you get rejected periodically. Someone they don't like your proposal. They don't like your pricing. Sometimes they don't tell you anything, which is like the worst. They just ghost you, you know, and right. For a while I used to take it personally, but then I realized I've done the same thing. If someone's giving me a quote that I decide I don't need anymore, I don't even get back with them. So I do the same thing to other people. So I realized that, you know, I need to stop taking this up personally and just use it as an opportunity to grow. And if, you know, if there's a way to get feedback about something, then about why someone's rejecting you, I try to get that feedback, because I realize from a sales perspective, people will buy from you if they know you, if they like you, and they trust you. So if one of those three things is missing, they're probably not going to buy from you. So, you know, when you talk to them, whoever next, try to make sure you incorporate those three things.
I see. Yeah, that's a good tip there. Yeah. For the month of May, my challenge was to put myself up more out there, which is how we got to this point, right?
Like, yeah, yeah.
I knew I wanted an interview. I knew that I wasn't going to be able to grow if I didn't start reaching out. So, I listened to a TED Talk. I don't know if you've seen this, about a guy who got rejected like 1,000 times or something, like 1,000,000 times. Like he just went, he set forth the goal to get rejected every day. So he would do wild and crazy things. Like he would go and ask for a refill at a burger place, not for a drink, but for another burger. Right. He like intentionally went and put himself in scenarios where he knew he was going to get rejected, just so he can get comfortable with rejection. And then he realized after a couple, like a few dozen rejections, that there was actually a trick to getting people to actually kind of like not reject you, but accept the proposal. And so he started like, he just got over it. So after that, I kind of figured, you know what, the month of May, I dedicated myself to like really applying for.
What's the trick?
His trick was literally to ask why. Like when he got the rejection, his thing was why, and just get that feedback, right? Because one example that he did was he went to somebody's house and he's like, I want to plant this flower in your garden. And the guy's like, no. So he said, why? And he's like, well, because I don't have a garden. But if you go to the neighbor across the street, she has a beautiful garden. Maybe she'll let you. And so he went across the street and he got the yes over there. So it's like,
interesting.
It was okay. Like, I guess he always got so scared right after the initial no, but he never bothered to do a follow-up. So I guess it was following through, right? And trying to get more information. And then he learned that rejections, they're usually for a reason, but maybe they can offer you a different way or a different perspective to take or a different approach to help minimize the rejection next time. But yeah, so it was a good TED Talk.
That's cool. We have to check out that TED Talk.
Yeah, it's a really good one. And that's kind of what I've been doing this whole month, is just like I'm on Fiverr and Upwork trying to find clients. And so I'm looking at things. And before I wasn't applying, like the month of April, I wouldn't submit a proposal if I felt I was going to get rejected. But now I'm like, I'm just going for all of them and then trying to tell them my story and trying to do that connection of like, this is what I can do to really help you, as opposed to like, here's my services, right? Like, this is what I offer. So I really try to understand what the problems are and try to help them. And it's been pretty successful. I've managed to get like 5 clients now in the month of May that have actually brought me on beyond just the Upwork initial scope. So they're like keeping me on longer term. And so that's where I was like, the month of April was such an emotional toll, but like I'm starting to pivot and learn and make adjustments and try to like grow this thing, because it really is. I knew I wasn't going to be successful if I didn't take away that safety of that job, because I actually started my LLC back in August, but I didn't quit my job until April. Right. And so for that whole time, I was like one foot, one foot. And so have you heard of the concept of entrepreneurial leap?
I think so, but what is it?
I think the guy's name is Gino. I forgot his last name, but Gino something. But it's this concept of, so have you ever heard of Pat Flynn? He's a smart passive income, SPI. He's pretty big. He's pretty well known. Well, so this is local to San Diego. In 2008, he lost his job. He was top of his class at Berkeley. He was a top architect. And then with the recession of 2008, he lost everything. And rather than like starting like the application process, he started his own business. Right. And he started at the solo entrepreneur level, and he started making like $20,000 a month selling like a training for a test that you need to do to become an architect. But in his study of this entrepreneurial leap, he talked about as he was still making $20,000-$30,000 a month, he still kept applying to jobs. Right. And he felt like he owed it to his parents to have a solid job, even though he was making really good money with a creation he made. But he explains that there was a pivotal moment where he was on his honeymoon in Hawaii, where he architected a P.F. Chang's, the building itself. And he saw people coming in and out. Okay, wow. And not a single person thanked him for that beautiful building that he designed, right? But his course that he developed, he would get hundreds and hundreds of emails weekly of everybody saying, like, you changed my life. Like, you turned my career around. You had such a profound impact. And so he said that entrepreneurial leap is the moment where you let go of that safety of that 9-to-5 job or whatever you have, and you dedicate yourself 100% to this entrepreneurship. So for the last 2 months, I've been really struggling with, I kind of have a foot, like a toenail, still stuck on like looking at full-time jobs and trying to, like, I'm scared, right? Like, I'm scared that I won't be able to make it. I'm scared that I won't be able to scale this. And so I'm wondering, at any point in your career, did you ever feel something like that? Like, did you ever feel like, you know what, I should just go back and deal with the unhappiness that a full-time job brought me?
That's a good way of putting it, the unhappiness. I don't know if I felt like I should go back. Because once I kind of got into the entrepreneur world, I didn't want to go back. But I did go through what you're talking about, the emotional roller coaster, the ups and downs, some days I feel like I was on top of the world, some days I feel like I don't even want to get out of bed. You know, that's pretty common. I think, though, from a, I went all in. I'm kind of a hell yes or a hell no person. I try to keep things out of the maybe category. So when you say hell yes, that means you've cut off all the other avenues. So when I did my business, I didn't look at any full-time jobs again. I thought, you know what? I'm going to make this work. Because I think necessity forces you to take steps you wouldn't take normally, because there's no safety net. So with me, with my own business, when I'm having trouble making cash flow or payroll because my cash flow is low, there's a necessity to increase sales. So that client that I was afraid to call, that prospect before, I'm now going to call them because I have to, right? So it helps you get over that next hurdle. Whereas, if I thought, well, if this doesn't work out, I'm going to go back to a full-time job, I may not have made that call or got out of that hurdle or developed those new skills. And I talk about like the high performance habits in my book, the 6 habits of high performers, and necessity is one of them. You know, if we can generate necessity within ourselves, we'll develop the courage, which is another one of those habits, to take those steps, to put out that proposal, like you said, even though you may get rejected, because you realize there's no safety net anymore. So that's a different perspective. Yeah.
Okay. Well, again, we're going to shift a little bit.
Okay.
I wanted to talk a little bit about social media and cybersecurity. I know that when I took my very first course with you, this is a completely true story. I don't know if I ever shared it with you, but I remember that first night after I took that first class, I went home and I went straight and unplugged the router. And my wife was like, what are you doing? And I told her, I was like, we're never going on the internet ever again. And I love to tell everybody that story because it's legitimately what I did after I took my first cybersecurity class. So I've been on social media quite a bit. So I've been trying to build a brand for my business, for my hustle here that I've been trying to grow. And TikTok has been a huge piece of it, right? I put a video that showed 5 cybersecurity certifications you can get. And I literally just flashed them on the screen. And 90,000 views later and like 2,000 new followers later, like that video like helped leapfrog me into existence, right? But now that I kind of have this following, I've been putting a lot of videos and trying to help people with like ransomware, online like data privacy and stuff like that. But a common question that I'm always getting is on certs and education and like bachelor's and stuff. And so I know in your book, the first couple of chapters were talking about those paper tigers. And let me tell you, the impact that a paper tiger has had on me is astronomical.
Okay.
Because it's just so, looking back in my 11-year career, obviously I haven't had a 30-year career like you, but in the 11 years that I've been in the industry, like I was flooded with paper tigers everywhere, right? And I wish I would have learned this concept of a paper tiger 11 years ago, because even now as I'm looking and applying for, like, again, submitting proposals, many of these are looking and they won't even consider you without the certifications, right? And so in my world of technical program management that I'm in now, the certified Scrum Master and the PMP, which is the Project Management Professional, they're huge certifications that they're very similar to like CISSP and CEH. But anyways, going back to the TikTok, is the big question that I'm always getting is like, well, should I get a cert or should I get a degree? And I know, I kind of know what your answer is going to be, which is going to be like probably neither, right? But my next follow-up question, which is really the one I'm trying to get deeper with you here, is I know in the book you're proponent for, like, again, the paper tigers, the degrees aren't making the engineer or the person, right? Because it's the application and their ability to actually execute that makes the bigger difference, right? But how do you see the shift in the workforce? Because without these certifications or without degrees, it's still almost impossible to even like be considered for a job. So do you see a shift, or do you see that there's going to have to be a shift? Like, what are your thoughts there? If you don't get
it. My thoughts are there has to be a shift. Yeah, there has to be a shift. We keep talking about this cybersecurity skills gap, which I think is largely a bunch of BS, because we've inflated the job requirements to the point where there's not enough qualified people, because we require a degree. We require several certifications. And there's simply not enough people with that, because as employers, the employers in general want to shift the burden of getting qualified people that are already trained to a college or certification body. So I think to fix the skills gap, we need to look at people without degrees. I still see value in certifications. A lot of certifications are paper tiger based, though. You know, you can take a multiple choice test and you don't really know anything, including the CISSP, which is supposed to be, you know, the greatest certification since sliced bread. I have a CISSP.
Not to interrupt you, but I was thinking about, because I was just talking, I do a live stream every day to my TikTok community.
Yeah.
And I was like, I bring out this like 1400 page book, and I'm like, there's nothing in this book when a hacker actually enters your network that you're going to find useful at all.
Exactly.
There's like not a single application in there that's like, this is how you stop the bad guy.
Exactly. So there are some certifications, though, that I think, like Security Plus, they're trying to make it a little more practical, a little more application based. You know, can I apply this knowledge? Certified Ethical Hacker has the CEH Master, which requires a practical. So a lot of the certifications are moving towards that, which I think will help you. You know, if you're trying to differentiate yourself from somebody else with a job. But if I had to choose one or the other, you know, 4 years to go to college and, you know, a couple $100,000 later versus several months to get a couple certifications and a few $1,000s, it's pretty much cut and dry which decision should be made. And then it's not just the certification, it's also, you know, how you do the interview. You know, a lot of people will get certified, but then they don't show up in the right clothes for the interview. They don't know how to handle the questions or ill-prepared. And then they blame their lack of credentials on why they didn't get the job. Whereas if they had developed some of those people skills or EQ skills or some charisma, or they understood how to build rapport or how to demonstrate their value or articulate their value to the company that's trying to hire them, they would differentiate themselves over somebody else as long as they get the interview. So I think that's... overlooked a lot of the time. People purely focus on the technical certification, but then they blow the interview. So yeah, I think between those two, certainly certifications have value for a differentiator. I would focus on ones that have a practical component, and then also focus on how to kill it in the interview and how to do a great resume.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so another common question that I get on a similar line is, as a software engineer, there's a lot of resources to get started, right? For complete newbies to like jump and write in their first line of code. But in cybersecurity, this is something that I haven't seen, and I'm hoping maybe you, since you have a broader, or you've been in the field a lot longer, is how does someone like at a maybe a senior in high school start getting interested or start actually learning hands-on activities? Because my only advice I've been telling people is like download Wireshark and learn the heck out of the tool, right? Like actually learn how to apply it. Download Kali Linux and go through the tools, learn how to use Metasploit, learn how to do it. But other than that, there's no hand-holding simulation or guide that I've seen that is either free or cheaper. Most of the stuff, like I know offensive security has like labs and stuff, but those are usually a little bit more out of reach for a high schooler and stuff like that. So do you know of anything, or do you have any tips, or is that something we can develop and put out there?
Well, I think it depends on what you want to do in cybersecurity. A lot of people say, how do I get in cybersecurity? And my next question is, what do you want to do? Because cybersecurity is extremely broad. You could do auditing and compliance, which you don't need hands-on experience for that. You know, it's a different mindset, a different skill set. If you want to do hacking, you know, like penetration testing, that's a completely different skill set than doing forensics or incident response. There's a little bit of overlap, but I think people need to first take a step back and figure out what they want to do. You know, do they want to take a defensive track, which involves, you know, forensics, offensive, which is penetration testing, or maybe compliance. So those are kind of three broad categories. And then once you know what you want to do.
But for an 18-year-old.
Yeah.
No, but for an 18-year-old, that's challenging, right? Because not only are you, A, going to college and you're going to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars to determine that what the rest of your life is going to look like, but now you're like, how do you even, like, because with Free Code Camp, I don't know if you've heard of freecodecamp.org. Yeah. You can go in there and you can get your feet wet, right? You can try seven different specialties in the world of software engineering and kind of get some exposure. But how is a kid supposed to know what it is? Because then, and the other reason I'm asking is, like, I spent a lot of time, even when I was in St. Louis, encouraging kids to become engineers, right? And I've noticed that at the high school level, they're kind of already dead set on what they want to do. So there is, like, I've been thinking of writing, like, even a children's book on, like, passwords, right? Because my kids, when they went home for the pandemic, like, he had to make a password to log into his computer, but he had no idea how to make a secure password, right? And so things like that. Like, I guess the bigger question I'm trying to say is, like, how do we lower the barrier to even understand the concepts of cybersecurity down to, like, an elementary level or grade school level, so that at least kids, when they're graduating from high school, they have a better understanding of what they want to do?
Yeah, it's a good point. So, and I talk about this a lot with people. I think cybersecurity ultimately boils down to risk. You know, there's like your car, right? Your car has a lock on it to keep people from breaking in the car. It's the same thing with cybersecurity. And then if someone breaks into the car, you call the cops to do the investigation. It's sort of the same thing. And whoever manufactures the car makes sure the locks work. So from a compliance perspective, a defense perspective, and then you hire someone to try to break in the car from an offense perspective. You know, those are kind of the avenues. But I think from a personality perspective, those are all very different personality types. So I'm a big fan of, like, assessment exams. Like, you can go to 16personalities.com and take a free test that'll give you an idea of what your behavior and your motivations are like. And if you get easily frustrated, for instance, then doing penetration testing, as much as you want to do it, it's going to be frustrating for you. So it's a good idea to do, even at high school age, before you commit to something, to take some assessment exams. And I mentioned 16personalities.com because it's free, to understand your strengths and weaknesses. And then when you're doing some research on what you want to do, try to find something that aligns with what your personality type is. Because like me, I hate compliance. I hate process. I can't stand talking about stuff like FedRAMP and audits. It drives me insane. But if I didn't know that about myself, I might have thought this is the way to go. And I'd have this miserable job doing this stuff that I really can't stand. Penetration testing, I like. I like challenge. I like to persevere. I like banging my head against the wall 1,000 times and then 1,001 time I get through. I like that. But a lot of people don't like that. So I think understanding a little bit about where you're coming from and what skill set and traits are involved with that area of cybersecurity is important. At least it's for me.
Yeah, I definitely think, again, though, we don't learn enough even going through school about this stuff, right? Like, unless you become a psych major, you're never going to even bother doing these things. So I know we're running out of time here, so I kind of wanted to shift yet again one last time here.
All right.
And talk about a couple different things. I wanted to talk a little bit about just Radical Candor. I don't know if you've heard of it or if you've kind of seen it, but in Silicon Valley, it's a very common way of managing your employees. And so I think you didn't mention it in your book, but I almost feel like it's the 180 of everything you discussed. And so I kind of wanted to see, like, if you're familiar with it, then we can talk a little bit more. But if not, then we could probably skip it. But just how much are you familiar with Radical Candor? I guess the first question.
So I'm familiar with Radical Candor. Why don't you describe it in the context of how you understand it?
So as my manager used to practice Radical Candor on me, right? And it's just being completely honest and direct with the person. But where I see Radical Candor fall into pieces is the lack of empathy that we as technical people don't have, right? Because I can tell you something direct because the whole point is to be clear, right? But too much clarity sometimes can really hurt somebody, right? Especially if the way you deliver the message is in maybe not in bad intention, but it definitely comes off as wrong. And so I'm just wondering, like, is there a way to maybe practice radical candor, but also kind of fold in some of the EQ skills that you preach?
Yes. So I am a fan of radical candor and the definition you gave me, because I talk about empathy. I talk about feedback in the book. I think it's important to not attack the person as, you know, not make a judgment against a person when you're giving feedback. You're really discussing the behavior and you need to have empathy for the person. And I talk about NLP in my book and different models of the world, and each of us has a different model of the world. So when you're applying something like radical candor and you've got like feedback you're giving somebody, you have to realize that the person you're talking to has a different view of things than you do. So if you enter the conversation with that in mind and talk about the behavior, it's a much different conversation. As example, instead of saying, "Hey, Alex, you're lazy," you know, that's automatically you're gonna like get defensive. You probably like got a little bit defensive when I said that right then. So that's not a good way of being radically candor, right? So I'd say, "Hey, Alex, you know, when we worked this project, I noticed you're a little bit slow in here. This sort of thing happened. Like, what was going on?" You know, it's a different approach, but it's the same concept, right? Right. I'm not labeling you as lazy, but you demonstrated something that, you know, could be perceived as lazy, but it was just a behavior. So I think it's how you deliver the message. And I think too many people, especially engineers, they like to like latch on to things like radical candor and use it as a way just to say, "I'm going to speak my mind no matter what. And if you get upset, so what? Because I'm practicing radical candor." I don't think that was the intention of with radical candor.
That's basically what I got, what I experienced personally, right? My manager was a tech person. He became a lead. Then when I got hired on, he got promoted to director because it's a small company. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden he has me that he has to manage, right? But when I was at the big companies, I was always nurtured and I always had my mentors and my managers. They helped me, right? They guided me through my mistakes. But here it was just like, he's giving me like this radical candor and he's like, "Don't take offense, but you're doing this wrong." And I'm like, "But this is like, you're destroying
my soul. So that right there is a judgment. If anyone starts off a sentence with "don't take offense," you know, that's a judgment. That's not the right way to give feedback. Right. So no matter how you justify it. Yes.
All right. So last couple of questions, best tacos ever for you. Where at? What city or place?
Gilberto's. And there's one in Moab. I found it. And there's one in Sioux Falls as well. I love Gilberto's. In fact, I was in Sioux Falls a couple weekends ago and I ate there like every single day. They have barbacoa, arrabbiata, chicharrón, whatever. They have like great tacos and great churros. Yeah, they're awesome. By far the best. Besides Mexico.
One of the things I miss from the Midwest. Like, yeah, you couldn't get. Surprisingly, I don't like Mexican food here in San Diego. Like, I think LA Mexican food is light years better than whatever Mexican thing they think here is we got going on, which is. Yeah. Ironic, because like Mexico is like 15 minutes away, but it just doesn't translate very well. And then my last question here, I want to leave you off with like the most memorable mistake of your career. What do you think that was? Or maybe a lesson learned with it.
Yeah, the most memorable mistake was thinking I could influence somebody that had a fixed mindset to have a growth mindset. This is a person, I talk about Doug a lot in my book. Doug is really a combination of three people, but primarily one person that I used to work with. And I used to think that it was me that was the problem, that I couldn't get through this person, that I wasn't communicating well enough, that I wasn't taking enough ownership. Where the reality is, this person didn't want to change themselves. You know, they wanted to cling on to their identity. And I remember having a discussion with this person where, and I thought about bringing them on as a partner at one point, but they would piss everybody off. This person talked to, he would piss everybody off. And I remember having a discussion with him, and he said, "So basically you want me to change my personality?" And he got defensive about it. And I said, "Well, yes, because your personality is pissing clients off, it's pissing prospects off, it's pissing teammates off. So yeah, it needs to shift." And he refused to do that. So I held on to that person way too long is the biggest mistake, thinking I could influence them to change. But the reality is, not everybody is going to be able to change. And you know, now I'm quicker at recognizing that than I used to be. And that was a very frustrating scenario. But you know, I wrote about it in the book. So it gave me some things to write about, some lessons learned.
All right. And then we'll end it with hot wings or hot ones. Where can people find you? Where can they get more information on you? Where can they buy your book?
Yeah, they can find me on my website. It's christianespinoza.com or on LinkedIn. They can buy my book on amazon.com. And I'm also, the Audible version is available on audible.com as well.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be leaving a review this weekend.
Oh, super. Hopefully it's a good one.
No, it's gonna be great. It was a really good book. I learned a lot from it. So thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for being my very first guest.
Awesome. I've enjoyed it, Alex.
I talk a lot about Pat Flynn, and he was actually the first guest of somebody that started Entrepreneurs on Fire. And he committed to 365 podcast episodes a year. And now he's like into the thousands. But Pat Flynn was his very first one. And like the profound effect that first interview had on him was exponential. So I'm hoping 10, 15 years from now, we'll look back at this moment. And hopefully I can thank you in person for coming on and giving me this opportunity.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I appreciate the taco question. No one's asked me about tacos. I love tacos. That's my favorite food.
I actually spent a good amount of time looking through your like previous interviews and stuff to kind of understand. I get a lot of influence from Pat Flynn, so like his style of how he conducts interviews and stuff. So I try to copy that a little bit. But thank you so much again. I know you're a super busy guy, but I learned a lot. I'll talk details maybe over email, because I do want to share this out with obviously my following, and I'd love for you to share with your following. I just got to edit it together. So hopefully that's not a problem. but if it is, please let me know, and we can talk then.
Super. All right. Well, Alex, I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you, and good luck with the book. Hopefully you sell millions of copies. All right. Bye.
And that's it for this one. I hope you enjoyed this interview. I had a blast talking with my professor, reconnecting. It had been a few years. Please make sure you go and check out his book on Amazon and support in whatever way you can. And don't forget to share this episode with everybody you know. I want as many people to enjoy this episode. It's my very first interview. And based on how this thing goes, I'm hoping to have a lot more interviews in the future. So please encourage and show your support and share this episode and make sure you listen to everything. Thank you and have a great day. Bye.